Welcome everyone to our special Kollel Aharon Veleya dinner and class. We want to thank the Kollel Aharon Veleya, this mythical, mysterious, anonymous group that are making Torah learning available to all of us. Ein kemach, ein Torah, as it says. Without flour, without good food, gastronomic Judaism, you need that in order to study Torah. So we are taking gastronomic Judaism to a literal effect. So welcome everyone. Tonight's class is called Playing Games with Yul Brynner. So I have a little picture of Yul there just so you could enjoy Yul Brynner. And let me share a little Yul Brynner story with you, okay? I went to yeshiva, went to rabbinical school in California before I went to Baltimore, to Ner Yisrael, to Ner Israel. And I had a classmate. His name was Alan Avram Teichman. Haven't heard from Avram, from Alan in really long time. But his father was richer than Korach. I mean, he was a wealthy guy, big, gevir, as they call him, a very wealthy Los Angeles Jew who supported many good causes, had hundreds of millions of dollars, and Teichman came to our yeshiva. So Alan, as a backdrop, was taking flying lessons out of Ontario Airport, north of Los Angeles. So he comes in to sign out his aircraft with his teacher, his flight instructor, and as he's doing the paperwork, the door of the little office opens, and there comes Yul Brynner walks in. Apparently, Yul Brynner himself was a pilot, and he's coming to get the certification to take his private airplane out. So my friend Teichman, with his yarmulke, looks over at Yul Brynner. It's kind of hard to miss Yul Brynner. There's only one Yul Brynner. And so he picks up the paper and pen at his hand, my friend Teichman, and he goes to Mr. Brynner and says, Mr. Brynner, would you kindly autograph this paper for me? So Yul Brynner looks at my friend, takes in his yarmulke, and he takes the pen. He looks at my friend. He says, so shall be written, so shall it be done. And then he signs his autograph for my friend Teichman. You got to love it. Great story. I mean, it has to be that way for Yul Brynner, right? He's mythical, and he's a kosher ham, okay? Mm-hmm. I would argue, again, it's a debate. It's a machlokes. It's a debate among the rabbis. But I believe that if Ramses, whichever pharaoh it was, that was the pharaoh of the story of the Exodus of Yetzias Mitzrayim, if he could only have seen the performance of Yul Brynner in the Ten Commandments, he would say, oh my gosh, he's better than me. He was quintessentially Pharaoh, right? Charlton Heston, no, you're not Moshe. But Yul Brynner, that is Pharaoh, that is Paro. So playing games with Yul Brynner. So let us begin with the first, it's not in your source sheet, but with the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. Now the Aseret Dibros, the Ten Commandments, the very first command, which is written very uniquely, not as a tzivui. It's not written as thou shall do this. It just says a statement of fact. Anochi, I am. Hashem Elokecha, the Lord your God. Asher hotesicha meretz Mitzrayim, who took you forth from the land of Egypt. Now the word Anochi in Hebrew, in Lashon HaKodesh, in God's language, Anochi is different than the word for me. The word for I or me would just be ani. Anochi is an existential statement of who I am. So, for example, when Joseph is asked by the stranger, hey, kid, what are you looking for? He says, Es achai anochi mevakesh. I am looking for my brothers, but it's not ani mevakesh, it's anochi, meaning I need my family, my brothers, to be me. To be Joseph, to be Yosef. So likewise, when God tells us, I am the Lord your God who brought you forth from Egypt, God is saying something very profound. If you want to know me, and if you want to have a relationship, a covenant, a bris, and a relationship with me, then you have to know me as the God who brought you forth from Egypt. They're connected. I am the Lord your God, and then there's that word asher, who brought you forth. The two are inexorably linked. There's a chain. So that means that Hashem, the God of the Exodus, to understand Hashem, we need to pursue the Exodus. And that is why the greatest, most self-identified holiday amongst every Jew in history is not Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Again, they're very big. Many Jews just go to the temple, to the shuls on those days. I get it. But do you know what day Jews identify with? And no matter how far away you are from Judaism, you find a Seder, a Passover Seder to go to. It's an amazing thing, because on some level, every Jew, the neshama, the soul of a Jew, understands that no matter how far away I may be, I need to show up. I may be the chacham, the wise son, I may be the enosh elishol, the one who doesn't know how to ask questions, but I need to be at a Seder, because quintessentially, it defines who I am. And maybe that's why we're linking it up to, this is how you know God, is through the Seder, coming to your Seder. It is a multi-generational connection, the Messiah, the tradition that links every generation from the Sinaitic covenant, from Har Sinai. Okay, so now that we know that, we need to understand what the Exodus is all about, what Yetzias Mitzrayim is all about. And we're going to discover, hopefully, in a few short moments, something a little revolutionary, a different way of looking at the Yetzia, the actual Exodus process. So let us now examine source number one. So source number one gives us the mitzvah, or the history of the mitzvah, of matzah. And it comes to us in Exodus 12, which is Perek Yud Beis. So this is our parsha this week, Parshas Bo. That means next week is when we get out of Egypt. That's getting through the Red Sea, etc., the Kriyas Yamsuf, the Red Sea splitting, that's next week. So this is given in advance of the actual departure from Egypt. So listen to the words. Source one. And this day, meaning Passover, Pesach, shall be for you as memorial, and you shall celebrate it as a festival for Hashem. For 7 days, Shivas Yamim, for 7 days you should eat matzah, and you shall watch over the matzah. That's how you get the concept of shmira, right? The watching, shmura matzah, guarded matzah, because it's a guarded night, a leil shimurim, a night of watching. For on that very day, God says, I have taken your legions out of the land of Egypt, and you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting statute. Stop. So at this moment, this is the source for matzah. This is the source for matzah? But wait a minute, look at source two. When the actual Exodus happens, 20 or so verses, 20 psukim later, in the same chapter, listen to this. The children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 on foot, the men besides the young children. And also there was an Erev Rav, unfortunately. A great mixed multitude went up with them, and flocks, cattle, very much livestock. Listen to this statement. They baked the dough that they had taken out of Egypt as unleavened cakes. We call this matzah, for it had not leaven. Why? Because Kigorshim Mitzrayim, because they were driven out of Egypt, v'loyach l'mismameah, they could not tarry. They couldn't delay. They didn't have time to wait for the dough to rise. And also, they didn't have any tzedah. They didn't have any provisions for themselves. So that is the common understanding of matzah, why it has to be 18 minutes in that, because we were in such a hurry to get out of Dodge before maybe Paro, Pharaoh, Yule would change his mind, which, as you know, he did about 3 days later. So we're anxious. Oh my gosh, we've been there for a long, long time, 116 years of slavery, 210 years in total. We're going to get out. So that morning at Passover, we're in a hurry. And we had the matzah, but the matzah was ostensibly, according to source two, should have become beautiful bread. Only they were in such a rush to get out of town, it didn't rise. Now, isn't that the common understanding? Yeah, but do you see the conflict between source one and two? In other words, source one is saying 2 weeks in advance of the Exodus. We know exactly when this command was, because it says, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. It was the new moon of the month of Nisan, when they were given the calendar that we should ordain the moon and therefore the construct and appointment of all the seasons in the calendar, the time was given as a gift. That was the moment 2 weeks before Passover, they were given already in source one, the concept of matzah and how to make matzah. So that meant that the Shatzer Manischewitz factories were up and running for 2 weeks in Goshen, in Egypt. Mm-hmm. They were up there 2 weeks before they got out of Egypt, right? So then why are you telling me in source two that, oh, it was only as a byproduct of them being hurried and rushed, shoot out of town, that they couldn't wait for the matzah to rise? That's not true. They were already baking the matzah in advance. So there's an idea of precognition, right? It's a great concept, right? But it's weird, right? In other words, this is a stira, this is a big contradiction. Which is true? Is it the matzah in advance of the Exodus and the freedom? Or is the matzah a response to the Exodus and the freedom? You might say, come on, Rabbi, that's not so significant. Really? It's the most significant thing you're ever going to hear. Is it proactive or reactive? Now, what does this mean for us and for our world? So I think it's going to hopefully change your world just a little bit tonight, okay? Let's look at source three. It came to pass at the end of 430 years, going back to the birth of Isaac and the Bris Ber HaBasarim, the covenant between the parts with Abraham, speaking to God. And it came to pass in that very day that all the legions of the Lord went out of the land of Egypt. It is a night of anticipation for the Lord, Leil Shumarim, to take them, the Jewish people, out of the land of Egypt. This night is the Lord's guarding all the children of Israel throughout their generations. So it's a night of Passover was anticipated by God for a minimum of 430 years. Now, how do we know this? Because when you read your Haggadah of Passover, it's right there in the Haggadah. We start talking about, Abraham says, "Bama etah." How do I know, God, that my children will eventually get out of Egypt? How do I know that when you're showing me this vision of darkness, of Felah and Choshech, of this impending Yiridah, descent to Egypt and the subsequent slavery? How do I know my children, my great-grandchildren, how do I know they're going to be worthy of it? By what right? So what does Hashem say? You know how you're going to know? Yadoa teida. You know how you're going to know? Hashem says to Abraham, Ki ger yezarcha be'eretz lalahem. Because your children, your grandchildren, Abraham, will be strangers in a strange land. And they're going to be punished there, and they're going to be made slaves there. And at the end, Yitzu b'rechush gadol. They're going to leave with great wealth and power, and they're going to get to Sinai and get the Torah. That's my promise to you. That is called the covenant of the parts. It showed Abraham the future. So for a minimum of 430 years, Hashem kibiyachol is mitzapa. He's anticipating, because it says it's a night of guarding, meaning Hashem is guarding close to his heart, kibiyachol, as if he had a heart, this idea that the Jews will be saved. There'll be a redemption, a geula. But it's more than that. You know how far back it goes? Creation! Because the very first verse in the Torah says, Bereshis bara Elokim ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz. In the beginning, Hashem creates the heavens and the earth. First, Rashi says, really, we didn't need to start Genesis from the point of Genesis. We could have come back to the story of Genesis kind of like after the fact. And we could have got straight to the Jewish people in Egypt. And it should have started with the words, this is the first month of the year for you, and then the mitzvah of matzah. And then retroactively, we would have gone back and said, oh, by the way, in case you want to know where you came from, well, there was Adam, there was Eve, there was Noah, right? We could have filled in the forefathers and the mothers and story, but we could have done that sort of as a byproduct. We could have cut to the chase. So that means that Rashi says, you know why we start with that word Genesis? Because God creates the universe for this amazing people called Yisrael. Shenikra Reshis, who are called the first of God's holy people. And it's the Jewish people's birth that happens at Pesach time. That's the first time we become the Jewish people, because that's when we go from Egypt to Sinai, and that's when we get the Torah and we become Yisrael. For the first time, we become Israel. Before that, what were we? We were the children of Jacob. We were Yaakov. Now, I understand Yaakov, Jacob got his name changed, but he still had both monikers. He was still both Jacob and Israel, alternatively, depending on how the Torah refers to him. Okay, so let's back up then. So it's not just 430 years that God has been anticipating this moment. He's anticipating this moment since the beginning of what we call human existence and time. Not God's existence, but human existence. Okay, so if that's true, what does that mean for us? That God preordained the second from the beginning of creation. So let's say, according to Reb Heshy Ganz and Dr. Presby and others, that they have a whole philosophy that maybe the Big Bang was Hashem initiating creation of our world. Let's just pretend that that's true, like Dr. Schroeder said. Let's pretend that that's true, okay? So 13 plus billion years ago, Big Bang, Hashem creates the Big Bang. That's the genesis, if you will, of our solar system, of our world. So from that moment until the moment of, ready? I know the date. The 15th day of Nisan in the year 2448. At the strike of Chatzot HaLaila, in the middle of that night. Boom! The moment arrived for the redemption to happen. So now what does that mean? So this is where it gets amazing. It's going to help explain to us a little bit about what Egypt was about. Let me ask you a question. Was the slavery and God's defeating Pharaoh with the plagues, was that, well, the Jewish people got in trouble and then God had to save us? Obviously, that's silly. It's not a fight between God and Pharaoh. I mean, Pharaoh kept saying, Jay, maybe you used all your arsenal during the plagues. What have you left? And Hashem says by the Red Sea, you know, Pharaoh, you shouldn't speak big words. I have a few extra weapons I haven't relieved from my arsenal. I'll come up with something interesting for you. Yeah? All right. So Pharaoh challenges God. Not a good thing, by the way. You don't really challenge Hashem. Not a good thing. It's not going to end well. So is the purpose of Egypt that we got in trouble and need someone to fix it? Or is it much more profound? So I'll give you the thematic elements here up front. Ready? The thesis is the following. Egypt is not Egypt because the Jewish people got in trouble there and became slaves there. It was preordained that all of that would happen. God, as we say in source number 5, I'll cheat a little bit, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says in the Talmud, always creates the cure, the refuah, before the makkah, before the illness. So before there is an illness that exists, Hashem has already cured the illness. It's a powerful idea. Means everything from the God perspective, and it should be from our perspective, is proactive, not reactive. And why that is so important is because if it's simply reactive, then it's arbitrary. Oh, so you were slaves? Okay, new. Then we need to have some liberty. We need to find a way to use some big weapons and get Pharaoh to acquiesce to the will of God. But if that's all it is, then the whole nature of it becomes very arbitrary. And now this, just as an aside, this impacts the history of America, if you think about it. The entire Civil War could be looked at by people who never felt liberated as a war that was arbitrary. Okay, the North beat the South. And as a result, the African-American population of America had liberty. They were emancipated. It was Emancipation Proclamation. Wonderful. But have you thought about this for a moment? It was arbitrary because what if the South had won? I don't know where we would be today. I'd probably be talking a little bit like this. I don't know. But if the South had won, we would be in a different situation, to say the least. Oh, my gosh. Right? So if you are being at liberty because a war happened to win, the right side won, and the bad guys lost, it's very arbitrary. Because what if it was the other way around? What does that mean? It can't be like that. And maybe that's why I'm going to offer that there's always been a struggle for identity amongst the African-American population of America. It's a very serious issue. It's been around since the war was won by Lincoln in the North, right? There's always been a pursuit of who I am. What does it mean for me? And I'm going to tell you the following. If Egypt, if the Exodus process was simply emancipation for the Jewish people from Pharaoh's slavery, we would still be slaves this very moment. Because that's not the way you destroy slavery. You know how you destroy slavery? Is when you are granted not liberty, but freedom. Now you might say, well, liberty and freedom, come on, they're synonymous. Yes and no. In Philadelphia, what does it say on the side of the big cracked bell? Liberty, right? Says actually your name. Dror, ukratem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshmeha. You shall declare liberty throughout the land for all its inhabitants. Your name, Dror, means liberty. Now you might say, but Rabbi, come on, you're playing with words. No, I'm not. The word Dror is liberty. So in other words, if you think about what liberty is, that's not a very good thing, but I'll use the sailor liberty, okay? When the Gerald Ford carrier pulls into the Philippines and they say, liberty, right? Right? The sailors, wow, they go out and they let their hair down, to say the least, right? That's liberty. That's being at liberty. Now, is that freedom? Of course not. Freedom is so much more powerful. Freedom is freedom of choice, where I get to choose things that are so important that they define who I am and what my world is. That is called chinam or chirus. That is a much more profound concept than just being at liberty. Being at liberty is going to the deli or coming to Ov Tzedek and saying, do I want the pastrami, the corned beef, the smoked? That's, you know, you make choices on the menu. That's arbitrary. It doesn't impact except maybe your waistline. It doesn't impact your soul at all. But being free to choose is a different animal. And that is what God is doing here. He, Kaseh Hashem, understands that the nature of Passover cannot be purely arbitrary. There has to be an element of precognition, meaning the moment cannot be responsive to the situation at hand. The situation at hand creates the need for a response, yes, but it's preordained. God ordained Passover once he creates the universe. It was mapped into Genesis, woven into the fabric of creation itself, which means there's a significance and a gravitas to it. Now, I've said a lot to you philosophically. How do I prove it? You know how I prove it? Because look at the story of the plagues. Let me ask you a question. Hashem tells Moshe, okay, Moshe, I'm going to bring a bunch of plagues, yeah? Dom, Sfardea, Kini, right? He goes through all of them. Blood, right? Goes through all the plagues. But it won't be until I get to number 10, the plague of the firstborn, Makas Bechoros. Then and only then will I break the will of Pharaoh, and then you're going to go free. So what's the obvious question? Cut to the chase. Just bring out the heavy ammunition. If you have the EMP option, right, the electromagnetic pulse, and you can wipe out Pharaoh in one fell swoop, why do you have to go through month after month, back and forth? No, I'll let you go. Who's going? Where are you going? Exactly how long are you going to go? All this give and take that took 9-10 months. Why do you need it? Just bring out the heavy ammunition. Finished, Pharaoh. You're going to have your own dead son, heir to the throne in your hands. It'll break your will, and then we're out. Now, that's not the point, though. The point of the process is that up front, Moses is told, it ain't going to work. Yeah, you're going to go through 9 plagues. But it's not until the ultimate Makas Bechoros, plague of the firstborn, where Pharaoh's actually going to say, go. And even then, he's going to change his mind 3 days later. Okay. Now, why would that be important? Because, again, it's showing us that the moment is at hand. The night of Passover was preordained to happen. So therefore, as you look at the story, and I shortened, I have like a whole 2-page class sources that I condensed to a 1-page just for the source and sake of brevity. You don't have it here. But basically, I'll just give you the give and take. As Pharaoh and Moshe and Aaron are sort of dialoguing as the plagues come, So the first couple come, and of course, what do the magicians of Pharaoh do? They're able to duplicate the first few plagues, like on a small level. And even though they couldn't take the plagues away, the blood or the frogs or the vermin, right? But they could like sort of duplicate them in a lab somehow using the necromancy and magic. All right, so once he sees that it's possible for the Egyptian magicians to duplicate it, what does Pharaoh do? You're not going anywhere. This is sorcery motion, Aaron. I don't buy into it. But eventually, when you get to like Kinim, to lice, they were so tiny that the magic had no effect. So you remember what the magician said? Etzba Elohim. It's the finger of God, Pharaoh. And at that moment, Pharaoh's like, he's listening a little bit. But then again, he just ignores. And then finally, he starts to offer things. He says, okay, wait a minute. You guys can go, but who exactly is going? And you can only go for a couple of days. And as he acquiesces, do you know what Moses does? He keeps changing the rules and the request. So in other words, he says, okay, how many people are going to go? I'll let a limited amount of men go. The women and children, they got to stay behind. You guys go for 3 days and come back. Yeah, Moshe? Is that good, Moses? Yeah? And Moses says, no, absolutely not. The men are going, the women are going, and the children are going. And Pharaoh goes nuts. So finally, the next plague comes. And then he says, okay, I give in. The men can go, the women can go, the children can go. And then Moses says, no, that's not good enough. You have to give us animals, because we're going to offer sacrifices when we get there, and we don't exactly know how many animals are we're going to have to sacrifice to God. So you, Pharaoh, have to give us animals and other stuff also. So there's a back and forth where it becomes like, what is going on here? Moshe, Moses, you just got a ticket out of Dodge, and now you're changing the rules, and he keeps changing the rules over and over again. You want to hear how outlandish I get? Listen to this. Finally, number 10. I'll read it to you. Pharaoh rose at night. He and all his servants and all the Egyptians. And there was a great outcry in Egypt, for there was no house in which no one was dead. This is the night of the first Passover Seder. So he, Pharaoh, Yul Brynner, called for Moshe and Moses and Aaron at night. And he said, get up. Get out from among my people. Everybody, I've acquiesced. I'm broken. You, children, worship God as you've spoken. Take your flocks. Take your cattle. Go and bless me. You know what Moses says? We're not ready to go yet. What are you talking about? Fool! Are we to get out of bed in the middle of the night? Who do you think we are? Burglars to walk about in the dark? We're going to leave in the morning. We were good and ready. That's a Midrash Tanchuma. What's going on? In other words, Pharaoh keeps relenting and giving in. And then the demands and the requests from Moses and God keep changing. So what was that all about? So let's look now at source number 4. And this is where we get the game playing. And in order, Uleman, listen to the words of God from Exodus 10. And in order that you tell into the ears of your son and your son's son, everybody's got to know this, how I, Hashem says, how I, God, Hisalalti, I played games with Egypt. And that you tell of my signs that I placed in them, and you will know that I am the Lord. Everyone doesn't pay attention to that pasuk, that verse. But this is the essence of what it was about. Ki hisalalti. Now, what do you call the mitzvah, the command to say over the Exodus story? We say sipur yitzias mitzrayim. To tell over, to relate over the story of the Exodus, right? This is equal. Uleman tisaper. You must tell over to your children, your children's children forever, hisalalti, that I played games with Egypt. Well, we now know what the gamesmanship was about, because every time the plagues come and Pharaoh acquiesces, then the rules change, the demands change, it's back and forth. What is it showing you? What is it showing you? It's showing you that it's not serious, the dialogue. In other words, if it was just about, I have to extract the Jewish people, then God would have said, okay, leave. He acquiesced. Get out, please. It wasn't about that. Because God had already preordained when the moment was going to happen. And the moment was not yet at hand. It wasn't the 15th of Nisan. It wasn't the original Passover yet. So what does that mean? What's the game plan? You know what the game plan is about? To show us that when something is arbitrary, it lacks holiness and meaning and purpose. If something is preordained from God, oh my gosh, then it's a different level of respect, honor, gravitas. And this is what Passover and every significant event in history is about. It can't just be a response. If it's just about, well, God has bigger weapons than Pharaoh, really? Like, that's supposed to surprise me that God has a greater arsenal than Pharaoh? That can't be about that. You know what it's about? Teaching the Jewish people freedom. Because what are the Jewish people doing? They're not slaves at this point. For all these months of the plagues, the plague did not touch the Jewish people, and the population was located outside of the direct Egyptian majority, which was located in Cairo and Alexandria. We were in a place called Goshen, which is in a distance. And what are the Jews watching? We're watching while plague after plague, dialogue after dialogue, and they see the farce, how it's gamesmanship, and it's going back and forth. And Pharaoh is unrelenting, and then he's relenting, and he's unrelenting, and he keeps changing the deals back and forth and back and forth. And you know what the Jewish population understands? They said, oh my gosh, how could it be? I thought that I was a slave. Pharaoh is the biggest, fattest slave of all. He can't even do what he needs to do to save himself. So when God warns him, hail's going to come tomorrow, call out the Egyptian broadcast system, get the cows in the barn. Do you remember what Pharaoh does that night? Nothing. And his livestock and everyone else who buys into Pharaoh's world, they all lose everything. They're slaves. Everybody dies who they left out in the field. Those who feared the word of Hashem, they brought their animals in the barn. Nobody died. And you know what Pharaoh said after this, after the plague of hail? He said, oh my gosh, I am a slave to myself. In other words, I created an illusory world that I'm a prisoner in this world. And I wanted to say, get the cows in the barn, but I couldn't do it. You know why? Because I haven't been listening to God or to Moses up till this moment. I can't change my position. I am intractable. I'm a slave. So this is what the Jewish people had to learn. Because as we said, if everything is simply a reaction, then it's emancipation proclamation. It's being at liberty. That's not freedom. What did the Jews learn from Pharaoh? That you might be the most powerful human being in the world, the richest, most powerful man of the world's superpower. Egypt was everything that America was and more in its generation. And yet, for all of that, Pharaoh was a slave. He had created a world that he couldn't move from. So he was the greatest Eved, the greatest slave of all. So the Jewish people learned, just because you are Pharaoh doesn't mean you're free. Freedom has nothing to do with your station in life. It's much more complex, and it has to do with personal choice and a willingness to make choices for ourselves. And so the gamesmanship is to illustrate to the Jewish people that none of this was for the purpose of you being slaves. Egypt existed so that you should be processed through Egypt to become a free people and to get to Sinai and eventually to Israel. And the manifest destiny that was at hand. Okay, we haven't answered one very important question. If God ordains moments that are inexorably booked in advance, so for example, as I cited, 15th day, Nisan 2, 4, 4, 8, there will be an Exodus process. If that's true, doesn't that eliminate my freedom of choice? In other words, we spoke about freedom, right? Like Braveheart, right? Freedom means an ability to affect change, personal changes, as we said, that have consequences, not just arbitrary menu items. That's being at liberty. It's not freedom. So if you tell me that everything is sort of like preordained by God, that's at conflict with my personal agenda, my personal choice. Where do I fit in? So for that, we come to the most magnificent source in the entire Tanakh. Ready? Look at source 5. Esther, Queen Esther, all comes back to Esther. Queen Esther has the most difficult choice of her life. King Ahasuerus has locked himself in his inner chamber's court. He refuses any company. And as she says to Mordecai, even I, the queen, if I come in unannounced, they'll take my head. I can't see Ahasuerus to plead with him for mercy of the Jews from Haman's evil decree. I can't go. So you know what Mordecai says? All right, Esther, don't go. don't go? What do you mean? If I don't go, what's going to happen to the Jewish people? And you know what Mordechai is saying to Esther? It's chilling. It's so beautiful. He says, look, Esther, you think that the fate of the Jewish people hinge upon your personal choice, my dear? You're a great lady. You have sacrificed so much in your position. Look what you've given up. I was married to you. We had a life. According to many, Esther and Mordechai were husband and wife. But once she was willingly with Achashverosh, the marriage is over forever. So she gave up a tremendous amount. And then when the story is over, Esther still has to remain queen married to this horrible Achashverosh. You talk about sacrifice. But we don't need you, Esther. So don't go. So in other words, just as we said that God anticipated the Exodus, Purim and the story of Esther was anticipated and also part of the Genesis nature fabric. It was woven into creation at the same time. That at that moment, there would be a villain named Haman, and Haman would secure permission from King Achashverosh to annihilate the Jewish people, commit genocide against all the Jews on Purim Day. But you know what was not woven into creation? The name of Esther or the name of Mordechai. No. The moment that was woven in, that was destined to happen. But the players who would be the ones cast to bring about the redemption, that was absolutely not written into creation. In the same way that it didn't have to, we spoke about one of our prior classes, it didn't have to be Moses, Aaron, and Miriam that brought about the Exodus from Egypt. It doesn't have to be Esther. So listen to what Mordechai says to her. Amazing. For if you, Esther, persist in keeping silent at a time like this, revach v'hatzalah, relief and deliverance, will come to the Jews from some other place, while you and your father's house will perish. Esther, we don't need you to go see the king and to save the Jews. You need to go in to see the king to save the Jews. Because it could be that this is your destiny. This is your moment. Maybe that's why you were taken to be the queen, to be in a unique position to step up and save the Jews. But you know what, sweetheart? I understand you might die. It may come at a tremendous cost to you. So if you feel that you're scared and you're not ready to go in, don't go. Some other technology God has already put out there that if Esther doesn't go in because she's scared, another Persian emperor will come and kill Achashverosh and Haman and the decree will be done. Whatever. There'll be a generic salvation. History will not record an Esther. There'll be no Megillat Esther. There'll be no Purim holiday. None of it will be recorded because Esther didn't go. The Jewish people are not going to die at the hands of Haman. So in other words, that is the freedom of choice. So yes, there are these moments that are so consequential that you have to have matzah. Both 2 weeks before there's a reason to have matzah and as a response to being harried and chased out of Egypt. So they're both true. In other words, it's true at the same time. I'm making matzah in the Manischewitz Schatzer factories 2 weeks before there's... So they're saying, they're probably saying to Moses, excuse me, Moses, you gave me these rules, you're having a factories make matzah. Why exactly are we making matzah? And you know what Moses says? Got to wait 2 weeks and I'll tell you. Can you imagine? So they're making the matzah and they're having it ready. They have the box, Manischewitz is ready to go at the Seder. And then all of a sudden, as they're harried out, they go, oh my gosh, this is why 2 weeks ago I got the command from God to start making matzah. So they're both true. In other words, in advance, proactively, the matzah's there. God ordains that the moment of Exodus or the moment of Purim, etc., these momentous occasions are going to happen. They're hardwired into creation. Who exactly will affect the redemption? Ooh, that's an open call. We are all faced with a lot of darkness right now, not so dissimilar from what Esther and Mordechai faced. Modern day Hamans breached our walls on October the 7th. And I wish I could say to all of us, oh my gosh, this is what you have to do. This is what you have to do. And this is what I have to do. I wish I had such clarity of thought to know exactly how we all individually and collectively could step up and make that difference. I don't have that answer. I'm sorry, I don't have precognitive abilities. I wish I did. But I can tell you one thing. We all have a role to play. And it might be small, and it might be big. Because remember, sometimes the little tiny things are the things that lead to the enormous things. Sometimes the little so-called inconsequential moments are so profound. When you look back, you say, wow, you mean I chose this and this, but the ramifications of that choice reverberate through my life because of one choice? Yeah, that's how life is. So choose wisely, because within nature, within the fabric of creation, God has ordained great moments ahead for all of the Jewish people. I promise you, we are not going anywhere. There isn't a world without the Jewish people, okay? Bishvil Yisrael shenikra reshit. I cited this Rashi. There isn't a world without the Jewish people. Okay, so it's a given. I promise you. The Jewish people are going to win the day. It's come at a tremendous cost already to us. And to others. At a great cost. And we're not minimizing the cost. Because it's horrific. However, at the end of the day, I can't see exactly how it's going to end. But I promise you it will end one day, that we are going to be looking back retroactively. We're going to see it in a different light. Okay, I wish I could say we're on the other side looking back, but we're not there yet, clearly. But we all have a mission. We all have roles to play. And I guess it's our job to be open and to be educated and to be on the lookout for those little Esther moments, for the Moses, Aaron, Mary moments. And may we all have the strength from Hashem, from God, and the personal ability to rise up and partner with God. Because remember what Mordechai said, we're going to be saved. Who the individuals are that through their freedom of choice will bring about that salvation, I think it still has yet to be decided and determined. I'll just leave you with one small thought. I have to throw this in. It's not a political statement, okay? If you had asked me before October 7th, who is the most unlikely hero... I promise this is MS beyond MS, truth beyond truth. Who is my most unlikely hero? The fact that I am saying what I'm saying to you now, I would put the odds 10 million to 1 that I'm going to mention the name of this person who is the most unlikely hero. Our own Senator Fetterman. Yeah? The idea that this man has stepped up to love the Jewish people, make no mistake, it's come at a great cost to him personally. But the fact that he is there for us, literally wearing the Israeli flag and standing for Israel. Wow. It could be that all the Vishigas, right? This is a Fetterman moment. So I'm just illustrating to you how one individual, and this is not a political statement, okay? But we need to let him know. I already have. I've written him. We've written him. Let him know to stand with Israel. He stood in the most profound way. If he can stand, we can stand. Am Yisrael Chai. Our Jewish people are going to get through this. I wish everyone a wonderful evening.